You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
Today on From Embers, we are going to share an interview with a special guest all the way from Hawaii. Pua'ena An has been a part of the Hawaiian movement for a little over a decade and is currently involved in the struggle to protect Mauna Kea, which is a sacred mountain for Hawaiians and is the tallest mountain in the world if measured from its oceanic base. Back in the early 1960s, the summit of Mauna Kea was identified by the global astronomy industry as having some of the best space viewing conditions in the world, and several observatories were built. In 2003, the 30-meter telescope Observatory Corporation was founded by Canadian and U.S. universities to construct one of the largest telescopes in the world, and chose Mauna Kea as the preferred site in 2009. Since then, there has been a prolonged battle primarily waged by Indigenous Hawaiians to prevent what they see as the desecration of the most sacred place in all of Hawaii. In 2014, the groundbreaking ceremony was disrupted, and in 2015, a mass campaign of protest, encampment, and construction blockades halted the project as the Governor of Hawaii, David Ige, issued a temporary stand down. After years of legal battles, the Supreme Court of Hawaii issued a permit to TMT last fall, and the government of Hawaii announced construction would begin this summer. In July, land protectors established yet again a camp on the access road up the mountain. Observatories were evacuated for several weeks, and dozens of elders were arrested, but many hundreds more held the line. 2.5 months later, the camp is still standing, gaining support and solidarity from across Hawaii and around the world. Typically on From Embers, we focus on the particular political context here on the territory colonized by Canada. But I do consider the struggle to defend Mauna Kea as part of this context, given the degree to which Canadian universities and the National Research Council are key players in this colonial project. Some astronomers involved with TMT have come out against the project in the face of resistance from Indigenous Hawaiians, and that can make a difference. So to that end, we will be posting with the show notes a list of universities and key academics involved with the project here in Canada, in case you feel inspired to apply some pressure in the place where you live. I was connected to Pua'ena by an acquaintance I haven't been in touch with for more than a decade, but I'm really glad that I was. He taught me a lot about the history of Hawaii, the context of anti-colonial struggle, the story of his politicization through punk rock and Hawaiian identity, and the struggle to save Mauna Kea.
My name is Pua'ena An. I live here on Hawaii Island, the Big Island. I've been here for about 10 years involved in various aspects of the broader, I guess you could call it, the Hawaiian movement. I did a video because with the encampment up there, one of the things that we have is a somewhat of an ad hoc university where, you know, community members and even a number of our college professors and whoever can offer classes. And what I did was I did a class and I called it Punk Rock for Hawaiians, Cultures of Resistance. And I basically you know, made a few connections and using like certain bands that are more or less recognizable to a broader audience and people who aren't as familiar with like punk music. And it was, again, it was primarily for Hawaiians. And prior to moving here, you know, I grew up in the Honolulu punk scene, and I was like a junior in high school when 9/11 happened, right? And so pretty much from then on was the formation of my social consciousness, and primarily through punk rock. And it was actually a more of an eventuality that I actually found my way back to my own culture, because I actually went to Kamehameha Schools, which is basically, it's basically an all Hawaiian school, and one of the only ones, pretty much the only one of its kind that exists in Hawaii. In Hawaii, it was actually illegal to use the Hawaiian language as a medium of education up until about the 80s. And when Punanaleo started, which is like a Hawaiian language preschool, they were actually doing it illegally, technically.
Would you be able to give a bit of a background context for what the anti-colonial sort of struggle looks like in Hawaii and what kinds of social movements exist there?
So, you know, when talking about the history of colonialism in Hawaii, we'd really have to start from the very beginning, which is Western contact. And here, the person who, quote unquote, discovered Hawaii was Captain Cook. Captain James Cook. he is a figure who is fairly, I would say, universally despised within the indigenous Pacific. I'm kind of going to skip most of his history in the larger Pacific, but what I will mention is that, you know, a lot of the places that he went to, he would not have been able to, he would probably would have maybe stumbled there, but he had a lot of help from, I believe he was a priest of some sort. His name was Tupaia, and he was Maori, I believe, which is he was a native person of Aotearoa or New Zealand. Now, when Captain Cook arrived here, and it was on his last voyage for a reason, which we'll get into, which was, I want to say, about 1778 or so. And the circumstances surrounding his arrival were very interesting on Hawaii Island, which is where I live. He did, on an earlier journey, on earlier journeys, arrive elsewhere in Hawaii first, but he didn't get the reception that he did when he came here. Now, where he arrived was at a place called Kealakekua, which is somewhat of a foreshortening of Keala o Keakua, which means the path of the god. And he showed up during the Makahiki season, which in Hawaii, in traditional Hawaii, it was the time of harvest and rest and recreation, and offerings were made to the gods. And it was about a 3-4 month period, I believe, from when the Pleiades arise in the east. And the conventional history of it says that he was regarded as a god, but that may or may not be true for a couple of reasons. During Makahiki time, and actually, especially on Hawaii Island, originating from, there was a heiau or a temple in Kealakekua Bay, a procession would go around the island, and they would carry a large staff, and it was basically like, it looked a lot like the mast of a sailing ship, you know, with white cloth banners hanging from it. And part of the reason that Captain Cook was called Lono is because this was the time when the god Lono, it was his time and it was his season. And so some of these striking similarities and even prophecies had existed that Lono would one day return on a ship of clouds, or basically floating on clouds or a floating island, something to that effect, with large white sails, and he would have white hair and such and such. And he basically matched the description. So whether or not he was actually regarded as a god is definitely up for debate. If anything, it was like a euphemistic description of him, and that he was treated with, at the very least, the honors befitting an honored guest. So when he got here, he got that reception. I'm sure that he was, I'm sure that he liked to believe that he was regarded as a god. But there were a few different things that happened. Supposedly, Captain Cook did restrict his sailors from sleeping with native women, but that didn't happen, and they definitely slept with native women, and that is where we got our first diseases, our first introduced diseases, especially sexually transmitted diseases, which from there on started to cause problems in the population. So one of the things that happened, actually, and this is what led to his death, was Hawaiians, somebody, I don't know exactly who, somebody stole a boat, one of those landing craft sort of skiffs or whatever. And his response to that was to kidnap the ruling chief of the island and basically demand his boat back as a ransom. He never got the boat back. We got Kalaniopuu, who was the ruling chief of the island at the time. And basically, because of that, because of his absolutely grievous offense on against a sacred chief, we killed him. And he met his death at Kealakekua Bay. There are, and the funny thing about this is that stories have gone around that supposedly we ate him, which may or may not be true. I tell it kind of as a joke. But what did happen is that the parts of his body, especially the bones, were regarded as extremely sacred and powerful. And I believe the British government only got back his hands. And supposedly he was eaten. I don't know if that's actually true, but it's funny to say again. So that's Captain Cook. you can't talk about colonialism in Hawaii without one of the largest figures in colonialism itself, especially across the Pacific.
So how did the United States become the colonial power?
We would actually have to start all the way back in 1820. And that was when American Christian missionaries first arrived in Hawaii. And this was within a year after basically the ruling chiefs had abandoned the traditional way of life, in the sense of we had what was referred to as the kapu system. And it was basically traditional Hawaiian religion, which governed every aspect of life. And that was overthrown by the wife of the ruling monarch, who united the Hawaiian islands under his rule, Kamehameha. I mean, I'm sure people have heard of Kamehameha. And it was primarily his wife, Kaahumanu, who, after Kamehameha died, engineered the fall, the overthrow of the kapu system. And shortly thereafter, Christian missionaries came, and that was when colonialism really, really began in Hawaii. There were, in the monarchical years, there were definitely attempts by, say, the English and the French, not even necessarily by their governments, by individual actors who were acting on behalf of or in the name of the English or French government. So fast forward to 1887. There's huge, tremendous missionary influence. Lots of white settlers came to start sugar plantations. And by this time, the Hawaiian population had been racked by disease. And by about 1897, we were down to roughly 40,000 from about the time of Western contact, which was 800,000 to a million. In Hawaii. So that's damn near 95% of our population. Now, mind you, by this point, foreigners could own land, foreigners could run in the government, foreigners were being used as cabinet ministers and advisors and such, and the missionaries had, now this is like New England Calvinist missionaries, very puritanical, and they had done pretty much what missionaries in Christianity had done across the world, which was destroy cultures, erase cultures, which is ultimately what colonialism does, right? His cabinet ministers, basically at gunpoint, forced Kalakaua, who was the monarch at the time, to sign a constitution that essentially stripped him of all his power and put it in their hands. after he died in 1893, his sister, who became the queen after that, Queen Liliuokalani, her government was overthrown by essentially the same group of foreign American or Hawaii-born or Hawaii-raised missionary descendants and what have you, sugar planters. And the American foreign minister and a company of Marines basically pointing guns and said, hand it over. And in order to avoid the loss of life and bloodshed and whatnot, because mind you, our population being what it was at that time, she yielded her authority to the United States, whom at that time, the Hawaiian Kingdom did have, we had treaties with the United States, with England, with Germany, France. You know, we were a fully recognized independent country and a member of the family of nations. After that, there were uprising attempts, and then there was a petition drive which prevented the United States from establishing a treaty with the usurper government, who referred to themselves as the Provisional Government and then the quote unquote Republic of Hawaii. And then in 1897, a so-called annexation took place. Now, under international law, you can't have annexation without two contracting parties. You need a treaty, you know, you need consent. But because that was never achieved, what the United States ended up doing actually was passing a joint resolution between both houses of Congress, essentially saying, just declaring that, oh, Hawaii's ours now. And so from then, the language was outlawed. Hawaiians continued to be displaced from their land for military bases, for sugar plantations, for cattle ranching, what have you. So we have what we consider to be, and you know, in several indigenous cultures, they have what they consider to be lost generations, you know, where our grandparents and great-grandparents were literally beaten in school for speaking the language. You know, our culture was stifled, or when we get later on in the 20th century, which was exploited and prostituted for, like, hula shows for tourists and all that kind of shit. It wasn't really until the 1970s or so, and this is right around the same time when the Black Panthers, AIM, Cesar Chavez, such and such, and we have these social uprisings, I guess, you know, feminists and hippies also. And what the primary thing that happened at that time for Hawaiians especially was what we refer to as the Hawaiian Renaissance. At this point in time, looking back, we consider Kalakaua's time to actually be the first Hawaiian Renaissance, because he defied the missionaries by bringing our culture back into the forefront. He brought hula back, and hula was one of the things that actually was banned for a really, really long time. But during our second Renaissance, because now we consider ourselves to be in the third Hawaiian Renaissance, there was the island of Koho'olawe. Now, the island of Koho'olawe was, like many other lands in Hawaii, was seized immediately following the Pearl Harbor bombing by the Japanese, in the name of national security and whatever. And up until about the 1970s, well, really the bombing didn't stop till the 80s, but Hawaiians were landing on the island while it's being used as a live fire bombing and training range. We're landing on the island, we're occupying the island, and they were doing so up until actually a couple of us actually disappeared doing so. And that was George Helm and Kimo Mitchell, who were leaders of that movement. And the primary group that was doing that, they were called the Protect Koho'olawe Ohana. Now, Ohana is family. Like many of our places here, it was very, very sacred, because what that island was used for was actually, that was basically where the navigators, the star navigators, would map out and plot out the route to Tahiti, back in the older traditional times. So that was a very sacred island. The entire place was used for bombing. And that's not to say that it was the only place that was used for bombing and live fire training, but that was one of the major ones. I mean, people from like all the way up through the 70s and who grew up here, they used to be able to hear and see the bombs from Maui. And it's, that's the kind of thing that especially as an Indigenous person, that like that cuts you deep. That shakes you to your core. Right around this same time period, which is the mid to late 60s, the same time period as Ko'olawe was going on, there were also a number of, I guess you could call them small uprisings, but they were definitely landmarks in Hawaiian activism. Kalama Valley, Waihole Valley, Waikane Valley. In certain cases, I believe Kalama Valley was one of them where the evictions really did take place. Waihole and Waikane Valley, the evictions were stopped. And this was this was in response to large-scale developments that were about to happen. And this is a really important one also, is Waokeleopuna also took place here on Hawaii Island. And this was actually about geothermal development. Right around in the 80s or so, a company called True Geothermal began drilling, or wanted to drill, in the Waokeleopuna, what's now a forest reserve. And in, I want to say, 1990, about 1,500 people actually gathered to protest the geothermal development. And I think about 141 people were arrested that day. You know, also, and I believe this was the early 70s, there were protests on the Hilo Airport development. Now, at this time, I believe the Hilo Airport had already been built, but what ended up happening was Hawaiians who lived on Hawaiian homestead lands, they were facing eviction so that they could expand the airport. And, you know, people marched and people actually jumped the fence onto the tarmac. And there are pictures of scuffles and some amount of actual, like, physical contact between Hawaiians and National Guardsmen. Now, Waokeleopuna and Hilo Airport, those were incidences where the National Guard was actually deployed. And that is actually something where up on Mauna Kea, there had been concern that the National Guard was going to get deployed, because as soon as, like, pretty much the same afternoon as the mass arrests that happened, the governor issued an emergency declaration basically over nothing. There was no real emergency, but he did it, and that gave him emergency powers. And there was a lot of concern that he was going to deploy the National Guard, and there still is concern that he is going to deploy the National Guard, but at this point it's not imminent unless he makes another emergency declaration, because as far as I know, he needs that in place in order to deploy them, especially in matters of quote-unquote civil unrest. One of the major things that happened in 1993, where that was the 100th anniversary of the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom, that was really the first time when Hawaiians came out, like, en masse for, like, to actually march in commemoration of the overthrow. The U.S. President, Bill Clinton, he actually signed into law a formal apology by the United States for the overthrow, for its role in the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom, and detailing several of the ill effects that have happened since then.
So the first observatories on Mauna Kea were established in, like, the late 1960s, I think. Was there resistance to the first observatories, and what did it look like back then, do you know?
Yes, there was, but it was certainly not on the scale that it was today. You know, that was definitely at a time when Hawaiians were marginalized, to say the least, and we didn't have the same kind of confidence in our own cultures. And the ones who resisted were considered to be, you know, the radicals. Something else that I had actually only just learned more recently is that the telescopes came in part as a result of the tsunamis that happened just before. And, like, the town of Hilo was not entirely wiped out, but they took a pretty hard hit because of the tsunamis that happened before they installed a breakwall at the outer edges of Hilo Bay. And astronomy, I mean, just like it is today, was looked at economically, you know, as an economic boon. But at the time, it was also looked at as a way to revitalize an economy that had taken a severe hit, you know, because of these tsunamis. And also, too, at the time, this was when the sugar plantations are starting to wind down and were shut, and they were shutting down one by one. And this was kind of also at the time when, just before, tourism was really starting to really come in hard as an economic driver in Hawaii. So that's some background information about that. Mauna Kea is the tallest mountain in the world if you measure it from the seafloor. It's the highest mountain in the Pacific, I mean, in Polynesia, anywhere. And we really do consider that summit area especially to be the most sacred place in Hawaii for Hawaiians. I mean, there are plenty of other sacred places. I mean, life is sacred, the earth is sacred, but of all places, that's the pinnacle. And we consider it to be the pico, or the center. Like, the word pico, actually, in common usage, that refers to, like, your navel. You know, we actually have three pico. You know, we have our genitalia, our navel, and the top of our head. The genitalia connects us to generations to come. The navel connects us to the generations that exist, you know, our parents. The top of our head, it connects us to the beyond, you know, that which is above us, you know, whether it be the gods, the spirits, our ancestors, all these things. And so because Mauna Kea is the pico of Hawaii, and really, if you look at a map of the world centered on the Pacific, it's kind of the pico of the world. And so to build an 18-story, 5-acre footprint, you know, two or three stories down, digging into the ground, a monstrosity like that, even if it's an area that doesn't really have a lot of plants, there's really only a couple of bugs, that doesn't make it right, doesn't make it any better. Just last year, there was a major eruption that happened on this very same island, where in an area that's commonly called Leilani Estates, the traditional name is Keahialaka, there was a massive eruption that we haven't really seen here in about 30, 35 years or so. The Kilauea volcano is the home of Tutupele. Tutupele is, well, we say Tutu because, like, grandmother, and we consider her a grandmother, and certain families are directly descended from her. Now, Tutupele lives in Kilauea, and our snow goddess, Poliahu, actually lives at the summit of Mauna Kea. It's the only place besides Mauna Loa, which is also another home of Tutupele, where it snows in Hawaii. Now, where this eruption happened, now, mind you, this took out almost an entire subdivision, lots and lots of homes and farms, and just plowed over a pretty sizable amount of the Puna district. And I'm sure that if you were to Google, you know, 2018 Kilauea eruption, you could see that it was big. It was really big. And we have in our tradition, in our culture, something that is kind of universal, and it's ho'ailona, or signs, omens. And I personally consider last year's eruption to be a pretty good omen of things to come. There have been other large eruptions coinciding with other events that have happened in Hawaii's history. There was an eruption right around 1958, 1959, and that was when Hawaii went from being a U.S. territory to a state. So, you know, the indigenous worldview is holistic, you know, if nothing else. And all these things, you know, that's part of our worldview, is to look at all these different things in the spiritual and the physical, material realms, and you can't look at them as isolated incidents.
Right. And so the 30-meter telescope project, I know the idea has been around since like 2000, and you mentioned they've been trying to build it on Mauna Kea since about 2009. What were some of the tactics that were used in this first round of, you know, with the groundbreaking ceremony and the 2015 blockades? What happened in that period?
Well, with the groundbreaking ceremony, it's basically what happened was one of our major movement leaders now, Lanakila Manguel, he and a good handful of other people basically just showed up and disrupted the thing and kind of told everybody off. and pretty much stayed there and chanted and sang until they shut down the groundbreaking. And I don't believe that a formal groundbreaking in the sense of how they do those things as like a modern ceremony really happened. Moving on to 2015, when we first showed up, we actually went up to the visitor center, which is about 9,000 feet, and we just didn't go. We just didn't leave. I mean, and I mean that in a collective sense, because of course people went up and down the mountain, and an encampment grew and grew and grew. We didn't expect that as many people were going to come out to help protect the mountain as they did in 2015. And people came from all over Hawaii. This is and has been one of the largest and actually unprecedented gatherings of Hawaiians on a single issue, and to come out like in force, the numbers in the streets, on the mountain, you know, it's incredible to even be driving, to even drive around in Hilo and to see like so many people like flying Hawaiian flags off their trucks, and to see like t-shirts and bumper stickers. And it's incredible to me, because we never thought that it was going to be this big. You know, there were several tactics that were employed, and to a certain extent, it's difficult for me to refer to them as tactics in the sense of the word, in like an operational sense of the word. A lot of things just really happened organically. And ultimately, I would say under the guidance of the mountain itself and our ancestors, you know. But one of the things that we were doing, actually, we considered it to be, we called it like an aloha checkpoint, where we pretty much stopped every car and that was going up the mountain, and either educated them or asked who they were and what they were doing up there. And this included telescope workers. And we did a lot of primarily education there, and informing and educating the tourists as to what was going on. And hula was definitely an element of that. And, you know, traditional protocols and lots of chanting and traditional ceremonies went on. Going back to the first round of arrests, which I believe, I want to say April, there was a round of arrests, and it was about 30 people or so who were kind of voluntarily arrested down around where the crosswalk was. And a number of these people were actually, were elders, were kupuna. And they actually came from, a number of them were actually involved with the Proteko Ho'olawe Ohana back in the 70s. And that continues to be the case. A number of these, like our grandparent generation now, is actually the very same from Ho'olawe days and from the PKO. Actually, practicing our culture and practicing our traditions has in itself become a tactic, because one of the things about what's going on here today is that Hawaiians, and justifiably so, feel that our culture itself is actually under attack, because the state's insistence, the university and the TMT Corporation's insistence on putting this telescope where they want to put it, despite our objections. On the day of the 24th, when that was when the most the mass arrests showed up, and I believe 700 to 1,000 people actually showed up that day, as law enforcement was moving uphill, one of the things that ended up happening was rocks, large rocks. I mean, some large rocks and some smaller ones ended up getting placed in the road as somewhat of a barrier, but at the very least to make it extremely difficult for those trucks to get up. And that was, I believe, what was given as the official reason as to why law enforcement and the construction crews pulled out and turned around and went home that day.
You mentioned that you sort of grew up in the Honolulu punk scene. So how did, what kind of politics did you come across in that scene, and how did you come to be politicized and involved in this?
It was really punk rock in general that really politicized me, and not so much the Honolulu scene in itself. Like, there are definitely bands whose subject matter was political, but the scene in and of itself wasn't, I wouldn't necessarily say that it was highly politicized. My social consciousness personally actually came about thanks to Anti-Flag. They are a punk band out of Pittsburgh, I believe, and they are a 100% political band. You know, they've talked about all kinds of things. You know, some of their more recent albums, you know, they shouted out to Occupy Wall Street. They were really big against the Iraq War during the Bush era. And I actually really got into Anti-Flag right around that time, actually. And it was actually at my first punk show, as a matter of fact, was Punk on a Rock in Honolulu, and Anti-Flag and Bouncing Souls, actually. And man, you know, being like a 17-year-old kid who, you know, my mom was really like born again, practically fundamentalist Christian, you know, going to a show for the first time, like a real show, and watching when they played Die for Your Government, watching the whole place go from like a couple small pits to like the whole place turns to a pit. And I'm like backed up against the wall because the pit is so raging that I can't even get in. I'm just like, whoa, you know, like blow my mind, opened up a whole new world back in 2009. And this year, I actually considered to be my 10-year anniversary of being in the broader Hawaiian movement, shall we say. 1959, again, was the year that Hawaii became a quote-unquote, I mean, we say fake state, you know, a state of the Union in the United States. And 2009 was the 50th anniversary of that. And there was actually a big march in Honolulu, which ended up at the Hawaii Convention Center. And, you know, that was the first time I really went to anything Hawaiian, except for maybe one other march besides in like second grade and going to the 1993 Oni Pa'a March. There was, well, one of the things, there were effigies, there were speakers from like Puerto Rico, for example. And one of the things that they, one of the actions that they did was in front of the convention center, they actually cut the 50th star out of the American flag and burned the star. The way they did it was really interesting because it was very specific.
Is there much of a like an anarchist movement in Hawaii specifically?
I wouldn't really refer to it as a movement. There are definitely anarchists, you know, and a number of them are academics, and you know, and that's where a lot of the more forward thinking is coming out of academia and from the activists. And ultimately, the way I would put it is, we're a very diverse movement. We have, you know, we have connections to several different movements across, you know, across the world and across the United States, and including, you know, what was the Occupy movement, the anti-base movement in East Asia, you know, Okinawa especially. But I wouldn't go so far as to say that there's like a strong anarchist movement here. I mean, it's just like with punks, you know what I mean? We're definitely here, but we're kind of few and far between.
Did you say that some people had gone up to Standing Rock? And so what was that experience like, and what kinds of connections were made and lessons learned from going there?
You know, the people who went, I can definitely say that they are among the leadership of the current movement, whether it's the medics, whether it's the upper inner circle of the main leaders. I'm not the best person to actually answer the question as far as what people have learned, but some of the things that are definitely practiced and spread around over here these days is, for example, NVDA, nonviolent direct action. We still do nonviolent direct action trainings regularly. I mean, almost every day up there. A lot of it's just camp life, you know, and how not to let the PTSD set in from just the fact of camp life, because Standing Rock is rough, man. You know, I didn't get a chance to go, but you know, I have some close brothers and sisters who are still kind of scarred just from living in the camps and the environment up there, both the physical environment and the environment of being surrounded by racist cops who want to kick your ass and maybe even kill you, you know, the helicopters flying over, and just even like from streams of people coming in from all over the place and hard conditions. And then you've got hippies coming up from Burning Man and like taking advantage and or disrespecting elders and all kinds of things, man. You know, like our medic healers was actually started at Standing Rock, and as is directly related to the medic healers up at Standing Rock.
Do you call it a camp that's currently at the site of Mauna Kea?
You could refer to it as a camp. I mean, what we officially call it is a pu'uhonua. Now, pu'uhonua is basically a place of refuge, and that's something that's existed from traditional times. So we did have laws that were punishable by death under the kapu system. We did have human sacrifice for certain purposes and human sacrifice heiaus or temples. Sometimes if you're a prisoner of war, if you broke a certain kapu, or if you were going to be put up as a sacrifice, if you could make it to a pu'uhonua, you were safe, and you would be, depending on the nature of your offense, you know, you could leave at a certain point. It's a safe place for Hawaiians to be Hawaiians, you know, like it's where we are, you know, we are pretty much coming from around the Paiaina, or you know, the country. And by country, I mean our country, Hawaii. But, you know, people are also coming from America, from other countries. And the officially we call it a pu'uhonua. It's pu'uhonua or pu'uhuluhulu. Pu'uhuluhulu is the name of the volcanic cinder cone that is across the highway from where the kupuna line is. And the kupuna line would be essentially the barricade. But it's funny because what's really there, when you hear barricade and blockade, you think of like barricades, you think of stacks of tires or whatever, you know, but it's like a tent across the road where the elders sit, and we do daily protocol, you know, we do our ceremonies three times a day, you know, music groups come and play, there's a medic station for the kupunas, and that's where our elders sit. And it's a beautiful thing. And it's not what you think of when you think of these kinds of standoffs. You know what I mean? It's a very, very Hawaiian thing. And that really comes down to, actually, is the principle of kapu aloha, which Kapu Aloha is the code of conduct, basically, that we conduct ourselves by and that we adhere to. And that is to conduct ourselves with aloha, you know, first and foremost. And a number of us, and most of us really truly believe, is that what that's what has distinguished our movement from other movements. And that's why things haven't gotten violent, you know, because we're holding ourselves to this standard. And even there's been a certain degree, even from law enforcement, where they have to like put it on ourselves, like, you know, we are going to behave with the utmost professionalism and such and such. And especially like the deal in our officers that are there just up the mountain, just uphill from us, you know, the ones that deal with us every day, like, okay, that even they say, you know, okay, no, we're going to be in Kapu Aloha too. And how we approach you guys and how we deal with you guys, you know, we will also be in Kapu Aloha. And that's something that you don't really have in a lot of places where there's riot squads and actual riots, or like what's going on and what happened in Standing Rock, what's going on in Hong Kong, you know, Ferguson or Black, or what's happened, how they've treated Black Lives Matter, you know. But that's a lot to do with the fact that a lot of these guys, a lot of these cops, you know, you can say ACAB, yeah, sure, but a lot of these guys are like, it's our cousins, it's our uncles, it's our brothers, sisters, auntie, uncle, our dads are, you know. So because these things are split across family lines, across community lines, like, it's on both sides to approach this thing very differently from as things are approached in other places, you know.
Yeah, one of the reasons I was wondering about Standing Rock was one of the things that I think about with Standing Rock is how many factions there were and how the internal dynamics were very complicated, both by a massive amount of outsiders who had shown up to kind of get involved, as well as just the usual sort of debates around pacifism or nonviolence and this kind of stuff. Is that, are people more unified, is what I'm hearing you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a very strong unity that is in place and that does exist. But that's not to say that, I mean, and I say this especially because I'm sure that your listeners are people who are more familiar with movements and the reality and the mechanics of actually running an encampment or running keeping a movement on track. Of course, that, you know, disagreements happen and there's some factionalization, but it's not I wouldn't say that it's nearly as severe as in other movements and in other places. And ultimately what it ends up coming down to is this is a majority Hawaiian and Hawaiian focused and Hawaiian driven movement. So it does end up coming down to the fact that we are all still family, and that even on the other side of the issue, we know that literally we are related to the Hawaiians that are on that, either on the state side of things or on the university's side of things. And we still even live in the same communities, you know, like some of these cops and some of these university people and astronomers, I mean, they're literally our neighbors. We see them at the store, so or at the gas station or wherever. So it's really hard for things to be as like clear cut, cut and dry, like this is our side, this is your side.
I'm curious, like, is there an indigenous astronomy in Hawaii?
Oh, absolutely. Now, we'll see, Hawaiian astronomy definitely absolutely existed. But we did it without telescopes, obviously. But I mean, Polynesian and Pacific Island voyaging was literally done by the stars. You know, you may or may not have heard of Hokulea, which was a Hawaiian sailing canoe. But they just recently, within the last year or two, they concluded the Malama Honua voyage, Malama to take care of Honua being the Earth. And they literally circumnavigated the Earth from Hawaii and back using traditional methods. Now, as far as Hawaiian sailing, it's not just the stars, you know, it's also the conditions and the sun and the waves and the wind and the clouds and all these different things. But we absolutely did practice a form of astronomy. You know, we planted by the moon. Our calendar was lunar. You know, like we knew when the Makahiki season, which was harvest and rest and whatnot, that happened when when the Makali'i, when the Pleiades rose. But yes, all, we had our own names for all the different constellations. We had Kilo Hoku. Kilo is to observe. Hoku is stars. That was an entire kahuna practice. Now, kahunas were not just witch doctors, you know what I mean? Like, kahuna is actually the word for any, for basically any master of your craft. That's basically the Hawaiian equivalent of like a PhD.
So obviously this project has been shut down before. So it does seem like there is a reasonable chance that this struggle could succeed and TMT will pull the project. I've heard that they're looking at another site in the Canary Islands. If they do decide to not proceed, will that feel like a victory to you? And what will it mean?
That would be the immediate victory, I think, because from the last time around, I remember that there was some talk where we wanted all the telescopes off the mountain, you know. But I know that this time around, the primary focus is, okay, stop TNT, keep this one from going up, and then no more after that. That would definitely be the primary objective achieved if that were the case. The unfortunate thing about it, though, is that that there is resistance to the TMT coming to the Canary Islands. I don't know if that it's as robust, and it would be an unfortunate thing to a certain extent for them, because the way I understand it, yeah, the Canary Islands is also suffering from telescope fatigue. But if TMT pulls out, then yes, we will have considered that a win, and then perhaps we can go back home and mow our lawns.
Recently, I read an article that said that the University of Toronto basically came out against the project being forced through, against the will of people who are on the mountain. And they've basically said that they're trying to wash their hands of it a little bit by saying that they're no longer have voting membership on the advice, like their advisors, as opposed to voting members of the board. It's been taken over by the federal government here in Canada. But do you think it makes a difference when universities who are involved with this project are making these kinds of public statements saying, we don't want this to go ahead if it's going to look like this?
You know, absolutely. I mean, every little bit helps. Every small win is still a win. Yeah, no, that's awesome, because, you know, ultimately what it comes down to is, yes, we can have support from other indigenous groups, but hey, you know, indigenous peoples are marginalized across the world. And this is kind of like a personal opinion, that what actually has the most weight is when universities, is when other astronomers take a moral and ethical stand on this, and they do say that, you know, it's not supposed to be science and discovery and all this at any cost, no matter who it is, no matter who we bully, literally bulldoze over, you know, because that's supposed to be what makes these things benign projects, is that people aren't getting thrown under the bus for them, or that indigenous people's beliefs are getting trampled on or whatever for these things to happen. Because if in the long run, these kinds of projects and this kinds of research is supposed to be for the good of humanity, is it, how can it be so if we are literally sacrificing some of our most vulnerable communities for it, you know?
How can people who are outside of Hawaii stay informed about what's going on and stay connected to what happens in the next, you know, few weeks or months ahead?
The website for the Pu'uhonua, I believe it's pu'uhuluhulu.com. That's P-U-U. HULU.com. Also, we are on social media. So, I mean, just look up Mauna Kea and you'll find something. And just keep spreading awareness. Just keep sharing solidarity appeals. I mean, people can do sign wavings. Go occupy your universities. Go write letters. I mean, all pretty much the gamut of activist actions. Use them. Especially for our more experienced activists. I mean, you guys know what to do. At the very least, if there's nothing else you can do, I mean, we're not everybody is spiritual people, but yeah, pule for us. Pray for us, or just put good intentions and think of us. Aloha ina, mahalo ya oko. Thank you very much, everyone out there, for listening. We love you all. Thank you very much from Embers. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah
take a look around. Use your eyes and sing Hawaii Kai. Around here, it's do or die, like in Bed-Stuy. West Side, 695, my car Hawaiian now. You gotta scrap or sell dope just to make it out. And we grew up having nothing, I come from the roots. And all the ghetto people love me cause I speak the truth. And rich people love me cause I never ask for help. And fake people hate me just because they hate themselves. Hella overtime, I'm trying to make fat stacks. A flamethrower in the flesh, spitting crack rats. Howley stole that from my grandma, but I'm past that. We ain't tripping, we'll just grind to get the land back. For the ups and the downs, it's a celebration.
Neighborhood anarchist.
More of an anarchist militant.
People involved in social struggles than everybody else.
People have been waiting for some content.
Radio and show.
The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Percy Goodness.
The Final Straw Radio.
If you're listening, you are the resistance.